Now, just for a quick review, the last time we finished chapter 6 last time, and that was where Moses discusses the corruption of mankind and the Nephilim and the daughters of women, and how that was an attempt by Satan to pollute the line of the seed, and how things got so bad that God finally determined that he had to destroy the human race, with the exception of Noah.
Everything in which was the breath of life, that included the animals too.
Yeah, I said destroy everything except for, well.
I thought I
didn't say it right. Let's make sure I say it right. Everything in which was the breath of life, except for Noah and his family. The fish are questionable. It would appear the fish were not destroyed, but there's a possibility they were. Okay. So we're up to chapter 7 now. And there's some overlap with chapter 6. So we want to read first from 6:19 to 7:9. And then we also want to read 7:13 to 16 so we can get a picture of the boarding of the ark. Now, you got to picture this. Remember it was 450 feet long? This was a gigantic structure, but realistic. Not so big, you know, that it's outside of the realm of possibility at all. We have oil tankers bigger than that now. But now, the ark has to be filled with all of the different species so that when God does start over with Noah, there are animals to replenish the earth of every kind. That includes birds. So, starting from 6:19, and of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing that creeps on the ground after its kind, which would include what? The serpent. The serpent was brought onto the ark. Not the serpent that had tempted Adam and Eve, of course, but we're just saying that that went on the ark too. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. Now let me mention it now. You see where it says two of every kind will come to you? One of the questions we ask ourselves is, did Noah bring all these animals onto the ark because they were under his dominion? Or did God just have them cut? And reading this, it seems as though the animals came to Noah. He didn't have to go out and get them. That's the way it would appear from this reading. As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and them. Thus Noah did all that commanded him, God commanded him, so he did. Continuing into chapter 7, then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. You shall take with you of every clean animal by sevens, a male and his female, and of animals that are not clean, two, a male and his female. Also the birds of the sky by sevens, male and female, to keep offspring alive on the face of the earth. For after 7 more days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made. Noah did according to all the Lord had commanded him. Now Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. Then Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him entered the ark because of the water of the flood. of clean animals and animals that are not clean, and birds and everything that creeps on the ground. There went into the ark to Noah by twos, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And then also reading verses 13 through 16. On the very same day, Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the earth, the ark. They and every beast after its kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, all sorts of birds. By the way, when you see that word cattle in the Bible, in our English language, when we think of cattle, we think of cows. But in Hebrew, back in Noah's day, cattle would be all four-legged beasts of the field. So it was a broader concept. Okay. So they went into the ark to Noah by twos, all flesh, in which it was the breath of life. Those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered as God had commanded him. And the Lord closed it behind him. Notice that's interesting. After Noah and all the animals had boarded the ark, God closed the door. That's interesting. Okay, going to the notes. Into the ark, Noah was to take all kinds of animals to preserve life on earth. So in effect, God is destroying all life on the earth with the exception of just enough to start over again. And one of the things that's true here, you might say to yourself, why didn't God just bring a plague to destroy all of the human beings except Noah and his family and leave the animals alive? They didn't sin. But the fact is, the sin of man can have an effect on an animal. And it can have a deleterious effect on an animal. You look mystified. Well, in the Mosaic law, if a man lay with an animal, the man and the animal had to be killed. And I think I told you this is somewhat of a heinous story, but some time ago, a Doberman pincher attacked a woman for no reason. She was going to her apartment and attacked her and killed her. And it was, after the investigation was done, it was fairly certain that the woman who owned the dog and her husband were involved in immorality with the dog. And that can really have it pollutes the dog, corrupts the animal. So the whole earth was corrupted with evil, and God just had to wash the whole thing clean and start over again. A distinction was made very early between clean and unclean animals. We know when we read the Mosaic Law, they're defined, but apparently the concept of clean and unclean animals was well known long before the writing of the Mosaic Covenant. To preserve life, Noah had to take on board two of every kind of animal, but for food and sacrificing, he had to bring seven pairs of every kind of clean animal. Now, I have to look over that again, because the source that I got that from, I reread that this morning, and there's something that bothers me a little bit about it. You see where it says, to preserve life, Noah had to take on board two of every kind of animal. But for food and sacrificing, he had to bring seven pairs of every kind of clean animal. Now, I would agree that he brought the extra clean animals for sacrificing, because he did do that when he disembarked, as we'll see. But when it says, but for food and sacrificing, he had to bring seven pairs of every kind of clean animal, I'm not sure. I don't think that Noah would have eaten any of those animals on the ark, because he didn't become a meat eater until he disembarked. So maybe those clean animals were being held until they disembarked, and then they would have meat to eat. But it couldn't have been on the ark. Well, he told Adam and Eve what their diet would be, and this is the, remember? It didn't include any eating any flesh. And it's not until Noah disembarks that they become flesh eaters. The distinction, The distinction between clean and unclean animals became a major point in the Levitical order. It was incorporated into the law. The ark was completed. Cages for birds and animals were in place. Food supplies had been laid in. All of this was made possible because of the faith of Noah. And notice what it says in Proverbs, righteousness delivers from death. It was Noah's righteousness that delivered him from death, ultimately. Noah stood alone against the whole condemned world and took its ridicule for 120 years while he built the ark. I mean, picture it for a second. He spent 120 years building this big boat, and in all likelihood, it had never rained before. And when people are asked him, why are you making this boat? Well, because God's going to have water fall out of the sky and cover the earth. They must have thought he lost his mind. And for 120 years he did that while he preached. He was a preacher too. It says he was a preacher. So it took tremendous faith for him to, you know, it's not easy to be ridiculed by everybody, but he was a man of faith.
Mark, can I ask you a question? What is believed that how the aging process was at that time? Because he lived so long.
Well, what you notice is that the lifespan of people after the fall, when death set in, and up to the flood, people lived for a very long time. Remember we did that genealogy and people were living for 600, 700, 900 years? After the flood, the length of time people lived diminished down to 100 and so many years. So Abraham lived 100 and some years until finally it settled down to about 70 years or so, Moses said. And many theologians believe the reason for that is that the canopy of water that surrounded the earth before the flood filtered out harmful rays from the sun that caused more rapid aging. It protected human beings from, you know, the sun, it's very interesting. The sun is a source of life, but it's also a source of aging. And you don't want to get you want to get some sunshine. You get vitamin D from sunshine and so forth. But too much sun is not good. And so there's a distinct difference between how long people lived before and after the flood. And most theologians think it's because the canopy was removed.
So the aging process was just so slow that, like, at 40 now may have been the equivalent of 400.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It was
a
very slow.
He was really strong.
Yeah, because he did it all by himself. He must have.
And his sons helped him, I think, probably.
Probably his son. But even so, you can see why it took 120 years. There were some big, heavy pieces of wood that had to be moved there. Okay. With every day of construction, he proclaimed the judgment of God against sin and the grace of God in offering deliverance. Instructions for saving creatures were amplified and the details would be repeated on the fulfillment of these instructions. First, God's careful provision and sovereign control of the operation are evident in this passage. Noah is acting in faith, but you can see that God is controlling the situation. Moreover, the matter-of-fact specifications about preservation of life and the careful notations of time throughout the flood account help to establish its factual, historical character. Poetic, symbolic, and mythical elements are missing. And There's debate amongst evangelical scholars and liberal scholars, and even some evangelical scholars, as to whether this flood really took place. But we know the Bible is the inspired word of God, and remember in hermeneutics we learned how to distinguish metaphor and so forth from, and there's no reason to allegorize this passage. It's simply not there, except for someone who wants to not deny the miraculous. All the days, when the word day or days is mentioned here, it's preceded by an ordinal adjective. And remember we said whenever the word day is preceded by a number, it's always a literal day. So there's a literalness to this. This literally happened. And it's not just a myth. Okay. Throughout this passage, the faith and obedience of Noah are striking. Noah did all that God commanded him twice. Noah went in, but so are the sovereign initiatives of God. God commanded, God said, and the submissive response of nature. There went in to Noah. It appears as though the animals came to Noah, that he didn't have to go out and herd them in. That's what the language seems to indicate, which would mean God was responsible for the animals coming to the ark. After God's invitation to Noah and his family to enter the ark, he predicted the flood would begin in 7 days. Thus, all deliberate speed, but no panic effort, was to be exercised to get the animals on board. They had a special trouble with chihuahuas. Very, very high strung. Why do you mock? And Noah rebelled against bringing skunk on board, but being a faithful man, he did anyway. Put him on the other corner of the ark. He predicted, okay, when at the end of 7 days, all the animals were on board, everything was in readiness for judgment to fall. God, who himself had been in charge of the whole operation, shut them in, and the rains began. Now, let me ask you a question, see how our memory is. There are two reasons God brought this flood on earth. Anybody remember what the two reasons are? One was because the wickedness of man was so great upon the earth. Every thought of his heart was only evil continually. What's the other reason? Excuse me? Remember what happened in chapter 6 in the Nephilim when the angels, fallen angels, cohabited with them? It was to destroy all in the Nephilim so that the race wouldn't be corrupted. Satan had caused that to happen so that he could corrupt the human race and destroy and make it so the seed of the woman would not be fully human. So those are the two reasons for the flood. Clearly the flood came because of heavy rains. Now, the rain that's being pictured here is not like the rain that we've been having here. It wasn't even like a downpour. I remember when I was in college, one of the things we used to do in the boys' shower room is somebody would be taking a shower in one of the stalls, and they couldn't see us because they had the stall side doors. So two or three of us would get buckets of ice water and just pour them over the door onto this poor person who would jump up and, you know, be pretty shocked. But it appears to me that this was like a worldwide tsunami. This was not just a rainfall. The floodgates were opened. It was an immediate flood. I think human beings, it wasn't that the water got real high and they swam around until they couldn't swim anymore and then they drowned. I think they were just washed away. That's how powerful this rain was. Okay. Additionally, the fountains of the great deep were burst open. Exactly what that means is not clear. Often it is interpreted to say that some convulsions of the earth crust release stores of subterranean waters. But to date, geologists have been unable to find evidence of such subterranean reserves or of any general and cataclysmic alteration of the earth's crust that may have eliminated such reservoirs by the collapse of geological structures above them. So we're not really sure what took place. But we know that it was raining, and it was water under the ground that was causing floods as well, like geysers, you know. Okay, now here's something that's debated. The extent of the flood, and there's basically two positions. One is that it was what we would call a local flood. In other words, the human race was not really worldwide yet, but it was just within that one area of the earth where Noah was living. And that's where the flood was, that the flood didn't cover the entire earth. The other position is that the flood was worldwide, that it covered the entire earth. Now, I believe the flood covered the entire earth, and here's some reasons why. First, in 719, it says, the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. That speaks of a universal flood. The phrase under the whole heaven cannot be reduced to a local condition. This will drive me crazy today. Okay, great. Get in there. There. Okay. Also, a local flood would not have fulfilled the purpose of judging the sinfulness of the entire population of the earth. Man had filled the earth. An ark would have been unnecessary. Now, here's a good one. Listen to this. An ark would have been unnecessary if it was only a local flood, because both animals and human beings could have fled the Mesopotamian valley and returned when the flood was over. Noah wouldn't know how to build an ark. God could have said, no, I'm bringing a flood. Move over here for a while till I'm done. See? But Noah needed an ark because it was a universal flood. The promise to never again destroy all flesh with a flood has universal implications. And E is very interesting. And I'll demonstrate it for you. Let's say this is a piece of land, right? Now, let's suppose I pour water onto this piece of land right here, okay? And as I'm pouring the water down, it starts to, flow over, and here's where the water is. So this is all water. And then I'm done. What's the problem with that? There's a problem there. There's an error there. Water seeks its own level. Ever hear of that? So if I had, and I poured water, it would go more like this. Well, of course, water seeks its own level. In order for it to cover all the mountains, since water seeks its own level, it had to cover the whole earth. And as a matter of fact, it would have covered the earth for about 3 miles. So you can't, it's just not scientific. And flood. large enough to cover the mountains, yet not worldwide. If it's going to cover the mountains, it has to cover the flat land too. Okay? Okay, next page. The duration of the flood. Many people believe the flood lasted for 40 days because that is the time during which it rained hard. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And so a lot of people think Noah got on the ark and then 40 days later he came off of the ark. But watch this. But Noah and those with him were actually shut up in the ark for a total of 371 days. It's a little over a year. They entered on the 17th day of the second month of Noah's 600th year and disembarked on the 27th day of the second month of Noah's 601st year. The chronology of the year in the ark, it's just over a year, is as follows. Immediately after God shut the door of the ark, rain fell on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and rain rapidly covered the earth. So that's the first 40. Then it continued to rain lightly for another 110 days. This conclusion is reached from Genesis 8:4 and 8:2, where it states that God stopped the rain 150 days after it began to rain, on the seventh day of the seventh month, 30 days month after it began in 7:11. Thus, the 150 days of 7:24 must be viewed as including two periods, 40 days and 110 days. So now we're up to 150 days on the ark. For the next 74 days, the water abated until the tops of the mountains could be seen. From the 17th day of the 7th month until the first day of the 10th month. So now we have 13 plus 30 plus 30 plus 1 equals 74 days. Okay? 40 days later, Noah released the raven, which did not return because it was able to scavenge his food. You ever wonder why the raven never came back, but the dove did? Ravens were scavengers.
What did it find?
Corpses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ravens were scavengers, but doves were not scavengers, so the dove came back to Noah. Now, of course, it's always possible that the dove was instinctually or consciously following the will of God as a sign to Noah not to disembark yet. Okay. So 40 days later, Noah released a raven which did not return but was able to scavenge for its food. 7 days later, he sent out a dove that found no resting place and returned. After another 7 days, he sent out a dove that returned with an olive leaf. After yet another 7 days, that's three sets of seven, Noah sent out a dove and it did not return. After an additional 29 days, Noah removed the covering of the ark. Verse 14. After yet another 57 days, God commanded Noah to evacuate the ark. So when we take all those figures and put them together, we get the 150, that's the 40 and the 110, right? Plus 7, plus 7, plus 7, the three sevens, plus 29, plus 57, totals 371 days Noah was on the ark. Now that's a long time to be shut up on an ark, and it was a test of Noah's faith. Noah may have said to himself, is this ever going to end, or am I going to die on this ark? But he believed in God. Where was he going to go anyway? Okay, now. Genesis, on page 32, Genesis chapter 8. The floods abate, verse 1. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark, and God caused the wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Okay, A, 1. We have looked at the chronology of the flood, which takes us to 8:14 in the last chapter. It is important to take note that although the ark may have been safe during the flood, they were not saved until Noah and his family were on dry ground. Thus, after the ark came to a rest, those in the ark had to wait 150 days before God sent his deliverance. Just as Moses later passed over the 400 years that Israel waited in Egypt, notice when you read Exodus, the 400 years of bondage are just passed over. There's no discussion about those. It's noted that they were in bondage for 400 years, but the narrative doesn't contain any stories about those 400 years because it's not relevant to Moses' purpose. Before entering the promised land, he passes over the 150 days of waiting on dry ground and proceeds immediately to the decisive moment when God remembered Noah and all that were with him in the ark. Now, it's important that we realize when it says God remembered, it doesn't mean that at some point he forgot and then he went, oh yeah, what was I supposed to do? When the Bible says God remembered, the word remembered doesn't mean you knew it, then you forgot it, then you remembered it. What it means is to bring into the present a past experience. For example, when Yeshua instituted the Lord's Supper and said, do this in remembrance of me, he was saying more than just remember what I did for you. He was saying, bring into your present experience what I accomplished on the cross. Make it a part of your present experience. And so this is what God's doing here. He's bringing into the present a past act. Or something in the past that he would determine that would take place. And that was the saving of Noah and the animals and his family. Thus, God's deliverance of his people is at the heart of the Bible and every story in it. Don't forget something here. Moses was writing to Jewish people who had just come out of Egypt. And there's parallels between that and the flood story. Because the story of the Exodus, when it would be read by the original readers, and they had just come out of the Exodus, and now they read this flood story, and it parallels the story in Exodus. And we're going to see in a little while a whole list of parallels between these two events. But just for you can get a feel for it, that God, in a sense, protected the Jewish people during the plagues that were in Egypt. It's almost like they were in a spiritual ark of some sort. And then he brought them into the promised land, and that would be Noah disembarking onto dry land. But we're going to notice there's a number of very interesting parallels here. The description of God's rescue of Noah foreshadows God's deliverance of Israel in the Exodus. Just as later God remembered his covenant in Exodus 2:24 and sent a strong east wind to dry up the waters before his people so that they went through on dry ground. Remember, he parted the sea. So also in the story of the flood, we read that God remembered those in the ark and sent a wind to pass over the earth and the water subsided. So you can see there's a parallel there between the flood story and the story of the Exodus, and that would have been recognizable to his readers because they were closer to the Exodus in history than we are. Okay, the command to exit the ark, verses 15 to 19. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by their families from the earth. It would appear fish were not included in the flood. The language would seem to indicate that. Now, here's something very important. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. What was the altar in the Old Testament? It was the place of sacrifice. And ever since the fall, the approach to God has always been through a blood sacrifice. That's not something that began with the Mosaic law. The first sacrifice was when God sacrificed an animal and clothed Adam and Eve with animal skins. And here Noah disembarks. A new age is going to come. And the first thing Noah does is he gives sacrifices to God. The approach to God has always been through a blood sacrifice. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, "I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease." Now, it's interesting he says that, and we'll see it. I'm pretty sure I have it in the notes. But you see where it says seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. They ceased when Noah was in the ark. During the flood, there were no seasons. The earth was covered with water.
I'm sorry, I missed the word.
During the flood, there was no cycle of seasons, because the whole earth was covered with water. And especially from Noah's perspective, he was on the ark. Even if there had been seasons, he wouldn't have experienced them. And no one was alive outside to experience them because they were all dead. But what God's saying here is he will never again judge the earth in such a way that the seasons disappear and day and night shall not never again cease. When Noah was on the ark, I think he may have been able to distinguish day from night because of that little window, but that would be the only way. Most areas on the ark, I'm sure Noah bought
candles
with him or lanterns, but on the ark itself, you didn't have the cycles of nature did not exist. And God's saying he will never again do that. Okay? All right, let's go to the notes. In the same style of the description of the entry in the ark, Moses depicts the exit from the ark, comparing 7:1 with 8:16. Look what it says. "Then the Lord said to Noah, 'Enter the ark, you and all your household for you alone. I have seen to be righteous before me in this time.'" No, I didn't read that right. "Then the Lord said to Noah, 'Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time.'" And then in 8:15? 16. "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you." Now here's something interesting. There's what's called the doctrine of the remnant. And that can be looked at from a number of different perspectives. One perspective from which it can be looked at is that God always maintains a witness on earth. In other words, there's always a believing remnant on earth. There's always a believing remnant on earth. Now, sometimes it's small, but it's there. And remember when Paul spoke about the remnant that was still believing in his time and compared it to Elijah's time? When Elijah said to God, they've broken down your altars, and so forth and so on, and I alone am left and they are seeking my life. And God said, I've kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So there was a remnant of 7,000. That's not a lot of believers in the whole nation. But in this particular case, the remnant was one. You alone have I found to be righteous. Noah was the only believer on earth at that time.
Well, is there a general estimate number of people prior to the flood? They don't know.
We don't know. We know it was a sufficient number of people to cover the earth, so it was large, but we don't know exactly. It was a large number of people, but we don't know exactly how many. Okay. The description. Oh, wait. Moses is careful to note, just as Noah entered the ark at God's command, so he exited the ark at God's command. God is sovereign. The righteous and obedient are obedient to their sovereign Lord's commands. The description of Noah disembarking from the ark, although condensed, clearly follows the creation pattern in Genesis 1. Let them swarm upon the earth, and let them be fruitful and multiply on the earth, verse 17. The picture given is that of a return to the work of creation in the beginning. It is significant that right at this point in the narrative, Moses takes up a lengthy account of the covenant. The restoration of God's creation was founded on the establishment of a covenant. And so in a sense, this is a new beginning. And it's described in terms that are very similar to the creation story. And it would appear as though God's starting over with a new creation. 5, there is a striking parallel between the picture of God's calling Noah out of the ark and the call of Abraham. And this, again, the Jewish people would have appreciated. Then God said to Noah, the Lord had said to Abram, come out from the ark, leave your country. Noah came out, so Abraham left. Noah built an altar, Abraham built an altar. God blessed Noah, and I will bless you. Be fruitful, increase, I will make you a great nation. I now establish my covenant with you and your descendants. To your offspring I will give this land. So all of these things would have had a more meaning to the ancient readers than to us, unless we put it in its historical context. We can see why when God had Moses write the first portion of the Bible for the Jewish people in his time, what's the relevance of all these things? It's so that the Jewish people can see God working through creation and through his sovereignty and recognize that it's God who brought them out of the Exodus to freedom and recognize that the life to live is a life like Noah of righteousness and so forth. The Jewish people all would have seen this. Questions? Wait, a little louder, I can't hear. That's a good question. When the land was finally dry, I kind of don't get a picture that they disembarked and there were dead people lying all over the place. Yeah, I don't know what happened to them. Maybe God covered them over or, like you said, put them in the sea. But I just don't get a picture of dead animals and people just strewn about. Questions? Yes?
Verse 21, you said, "And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done." Is that why you think it might have also killed off the fish? Because here he's just as every living thing. Chapter 8, verse
21. Yeah, I'm looking at it. Chapter 8. This is... Well, when he says, "I will never again destroy every living thing," within that context, he's saying, "I will never again curse the ground on account of man." Now, I'm not sure. There's indications that it didn't include fish, because fish don't have the breath of life. They don't breathe. And they can live in water, but by the same token, there are fish that can only live in salt water, and there are fish that can only live in non-salty water. And during the flood, that all the water was different. I don't know if either saltwater fish nor freshwater fish could exist in the water that covered the earth. So it's really open to speculation. Other questions, comments? All right, let's take our first break. All right, continuing on page 33, that one comment in the middle of the page, both Noah and Abraham represent new beginnings in the course of events recorded in Genesis. Both are marked by God's promise of blessing and of the gift of the covenant. All of God's blessings are based on the covenants he made. Now, by the way, some covenants are not in effect anymore, like the Mosaic, right? That's been done away with, it, and it's replaced by the new covenant. But the Abrahamic covenant is still in place, and that's why Jewish people should still be circumcised today, and they do. The covenant God made with Noah carries over too. All of the provisions of the covenant that God made with Noah are in effect today. Where's my pen? Yeah, thanks. Another pen I lost. Okay. We're going to go to verses, the altar and the covenant, verses 20 to 22. So we're in chapter 8, verses 20 and 22. Let's read. "Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, 'I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done.' While the earth remains," that's a kind of an interesting statement, "while the earth remains," because the earth is one day not going to remain, this earth, "seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease." Okay, 6. "Upon leaving the ark, Noah immediately remembered the goodness of God in preserving his family through catastrophic judgment and in singling out them alone to assume the responsibility of repopulating the earth. In gratitude, Noah built an altar and sacrificed on it one each of every clean animal and bird." And again, the altar is the place of sacrifice. Now, once the Mosaic Law was in effect, that place of sacrifice was in the Holy of Holies in the temple. And you weren't supposed to build altars in other places. You ever hear them talking about the high places and... those were altars that they would build, but they weren't supposed to be doing that. They were supposed to only be sacrificing at the temple. Okay. Another thing that this affirms is that the approach of God was always through a blood sacrifice. We see it in the case of Noah, see it in the case of Abraham. In 22:13, then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. That's the substitutionary sacrifice. We see it in the Passover with the slaying of a lamb and putting the blood of the lamb on the door. We see it in many places. And I think there's one more I wanted to point out. I think it's 13:18 that demonstrates this. Then Abram, this is 13:18. Let's start with 17. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So the altar and the blood sacrifice were not something new with the Mosaic law. And the blood, the approach to God is still through a blood sacrifice today. What is our approach to God? The blood that Jesus sacrificed on the cross. God accepted the offering and promised never again to blot out all the living things as I have done, that is, by a flood. The seasons that had been obliterated for a year were now promised in regularity until the end of time. Again, during the flood, there were not seasons as we know them, yes?
Yeah, but
if you theoretically, when the earth was completely covered with water, if you were in a boat for a year, there'd be no seasons. There's no trees. There's
Might
no.
There not be a temperature difference?
Well, there could be a temperature, but how are you supposed to know what season it is? Well, it depends on how you define season, but I don't think you can define season by temperature. If you define season by temperature, then every year the seasons are going to be in different places.
Are you saying that God stopped the seasons?
I'm saying that the flood disrupted that cycle. It disrupted that cycle. I mean, how would you know when... You know, spring turned to summer. You could have hot days during the spring and cooler days during the summer. All you know is you're floating in a boat on top of water. You have no trees. The leaves change color during the fall. Certainly there's no snowfall. It was all covered with water. The cycles of nature had effectively ceased. Now, there are also those, and this is speculative, but there's some weight to it, who believe that the earth did not always spin on its axis, in which case there would be no seasons, and that the flood caused it to float on its axis, spin on its axis. The problem with that is not in the text. Okay, moving on. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma. Of course, God's righteous demands were not met merely by the offering of animal sacrifice. The heart of the offender must be right if God does accept the sacrifice. This is clear from numerous passages in the Tanakh. For example, if you go to the book book of Isaiah. Merely sacrificing an animal does not bring forgiveness. And we see this vividly in the book of Isaiah, chapter 1. If I could ever find it. Okay, and in chapter 1, starting in verse 10, listen what it says. Hear the word of the Lord. Now, this is Isaiah rebuking Israel. You rulers of Sodom, give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. So he's comparing the Israelites to the wicked people who had lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle. And I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling in my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity, and the solemnest assembly. I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. So when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood. And that's far enough. And so what we see here is that without the without a blood sacrifice, there can be no forgiveness. But a blood sacrifice does not guarantee forgiveness if the heart is not right, if you're just going through the motions, or if it's just a religious exercise that you forget about the next day and go out and lead a wicked life. And there's an application for believers as well. You know, we're saved by grace through faith, but that doesn't mean we just float on into heaven without, what does it say in Romans 12:1? Making yourselves a living sacrifice on the altar for God. So the believer who is born again, but that makes the decision to just live life in the world and as the world lives, will be saved, but will suffer great loss of rewards. Yeah, my father died 2 hours. My father accepted the Lord 2 hours before he died. Yeah. That's why when people say to me, if what you're saying is true, then my grandmother's in hell. And I say to them, we don't know where she is. That's up to God. But we know where you are. You know where you are. You got to focus on them. That's just the smokescreen people put up. Yes.
In the early church, not Pentecost time, but like in the 200s, 80s or something, people tended to put off baptism until death was close because they wanted all their sins taken care of. But Constantine was baptized on his deathbed.
Well, we do that in our congregation. What we do is if somebody's in a hospital and they're terminally ill, we have the doctor inform us maybe a minute before they're going to pass away. And one of the members of the congregation, we take turns. You couldn't sit there all day. But we go in shifts of about 4 hours each. So there's always a member of the congregation sitting next to the sick person's bed. And when the doctor says, well, there's only about a minute to go and he's going to die, we pour a bucket of water over his head. Yeah.
Why do you mock? I'm trying to be religious here.
Like the guys in the shower, the ice water. Shock him into life.
Okay, let's read some observations now. Okay, page 34, some observations. In the account of Noah's altar and the covenant, Moses continues his close association with Genesis 1. As a result of Noah's altar and offering, the whole of the state of mankind before the flood is reestablished. Man is still fallen, but through an offering on the altar, he may find God's blessing. It is significant that just as in Genesis 1, the focus of Moses' interest in man after the flood is his creation in God's image. Just as significant as the association of this passage with the creation account, however, are the several close associations between Noah's altar and Moses' altar at Mount Sinai following the Exodus. A brief list of some parallels gives a sense of these similarities. So let's read this now. The building of the altar in both accounts follows a major act of God's salvation. God's rescue of Noah from the flood and God's deliverance of the Israelites from the bondage of Egypt. You see, looking at it this way, we get a better, this is what, putting it in its historical context. We have to remember God was not writing to us. He was writing to Jewish people who had come out of the Exodus. And this is what they were reading. And they would have seen these things far more easily than we do. But it gives them meaning. It gives them, it places them within the context. Okay, the building of the altar in both accounts follows a major act of God's salvation, God's rescue of Noah from the flood and God's deliverance of the Israelites from bondage in Egypt. The altar and offering in both accounts mark the establishment of a covenant, a brit, with God. The outcome of both covenants is God's blessing. The central provision in both covenants is protection from the beasts of the fields or wild animals. Specific mention is made that the earth will be preserved from destruction. In Genesis, the visible sign of the covenant is the rainbow in the clouds. In the Exodus, the conclusion of the covenant making is marked by the appearance of the glory of God in the cloud. You see where it says, in the cloud, the covered the mountain, it would be which, in the cloud which covered the mountain. See that? Okay. In both covenants, stipulations are given to which the people must be obedient. So the Jewish people would, you know, sometimes when you ask yourself, why did Moses write all this stuff to the, this is the reason. They wanted to show, God through Moses wanted to show his people that it was in fact him who was guiding them. And one of the ways he did that was by giving them a history, much of which they were probably familiar with because they were an oral people. And they would recognize that it was the living God who was leading them. Yes?
Well, I'm not sure now about my question. I'm thinking, I was wondering if you were saying that the Noahic covenant became, I don't remember the word, you have to obey it or the covenant is broken. Were you saying both covenants, stipulations are given to which the people must be obedient? The covenant with Noah, God just said,
well, but there's certain things in the covenant, like man was to become a meat eater. Capital punishment was instituted.
and a number of things.
That's perhaps a separate covenant. I was thinking about the covenant or the rainbow covenant.
Well, there can be aspects. There can be aspects of a covenant, as we've said before, that are unilateral and depend only on the faithfulness of God. For example, the Abrahamic covenant is a unilateral covenant.
Right, but whether or not the earth would never be destroyed by water.
Yeah, but listen, the Abrahamic covenant, all of its provisions would be fulfilled regardless. And so I'm saying the covenant with Noah, there can be portions of that covenant which depend only on God's faithfulness. And the rainbow aspect of the covenant, never to do that again, no stipulations were made on man. That was a part that was up to God and his faithfulness only.
That's why I just didn't like the wording in number 7. Both covenants have stipulations. There's a Noah covenant which has stipulations.
No, wait a second. I'm not saying there aren't stipulations. All I'm saying is if you would list all of the provisions of the covenant, some of them have stipulations. And there's always blessing for obedience and discipline for disobedience. But some of the provisions of the covenant rested solely on the faithfulness of God. There were no stipulations. Okay. What these observations suggest is that Moses is intentionally drawing out the similarities between God's covenant with Noah and the covenant with Israel at Sinai. I should have, see how I read that? Similarities between God's covenant with Noah and the covenant with Israel at Sinai. That's the way that should read. It doesn't read very well the way I have it. The reason is he wants to show that God's covenant at Sinai is not a new act of God. The covenant is rather a return to God's original promises. Once again at Sinai, as he had done in the past, God is at work restoring his fellowship with man and bringing men back to himself. The covenant with Noah plays an important role in Moses' of God's restoration of blessing. It lies midway between God's original blessing of all mankind and God's promise to bless all peoples on the earth through Abraham. Okay. Now, I think I mentioned it maybe in the next section, but one of the things that that theologians discuss is when God said, wait, it might be in the next chapter. Let me make sure. Yeah, it's in the next chapter. I don't want to get into it yet. Let me see how we're doing with time. We just went over. Okay, we're going to stop there because it's time. But let me ask if there's any questions or comments first. Wait, say that again.
Noah knew that
he was to build an ark.
After he got out of the ark, an altar. When he got out of the ark, he built an altar. And he knew he should do that because of the descendants of Adam that he was with.
For some reason, I'm not following. Start again. No, apparently it was known by mankind that that was, I mean, both Cain and Abel built altars. They both built altars. It's just that Cain's offering was not acceptable. They were what? Everybody except for Noah and his wife
And his sons and his sons' wives, that's eight people. Yeah. Everybody else was dead.
Everyone else didn't know the Lord.
That's right. That's what it says. So Noah was the only believer in the remnant at that time. Because God said to him, you alone I have found righteous in this generation. There was one believer on planet Earth. So it's possible that it can go down to a very, the remnant can be quite small, but it never disappears.